Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have been so privileged over the years to know and to admire and to get to work with a man who brings extraordinary intelligence to national security matters and a lifetime of work on behalf of our country in the face of a variety of threats, including, most especially, that very few of us understand. It is something known as electromagnetic pulse, or EMP, and the possibility that if unleashed on our country, either by enemies or perhaps even for that matter, the sun, it could have an absolutely catastrophic effect on our electric grid and therefore on our country. His name is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You have probably seen him elsewhere, including on various media outlets, calling attention to this threat as a result of the work he's done on it for, among other things, the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the House Armed Services Committee. He was also a member of the staff of the Central Intelligence Agency. These days, he's the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. Always welcome here. Peter Pry, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Frank. Always a pleasure.
Well, I want to talk about Rex Tillerson and North Korea in a moment. But before we get to him, let me just ask you about some of the writing you've been doing lately, the warnings that you've been issuing about the threat from North Korea and the danger that, in particular, it may well be positioned to execute this sort of electromagnetic pulse attack against our country with devastating effects.
Yes, the EMP Commission has been warning about this, you know, not just me, because they've got two satellites already orbiting over the United States, which is rarely mentioned by anybody in the mainstream media or the press. And the commission assesses that these could be nuclear armed. Just one of them could put an EMP field down on the country. You know, an EMP field is like a super energetic radio wave that can destroy electronics across the whole country. It would pass harmlessly through people's bodies, but it could destroy the electric grid, which supports life in this country. You know, we estimated that if we have a nationwide blackout lasting a year, up to 9 of 10 Americans could die from starvation, disease, and societal collapse. We're also very concerned that people are so focused on North Korea blasting a city with its ICBMs, which are now proven able to reach anywhere in the United States with this latest missile test. They're so focused on blasting a city, so they're looking at when can North Korea develop a reentry vehicle. But you don't need a reentry vehicle or even accuracy to do an EMP attack. They could use an ICBM or one of their sub-launch ballistic missiles. They do have a ballistic missile submarine now, or they could launch a short-range missile off a ship, just one weapon. And so we face an EMP threat right now from North Korea that could enable them not only to destroy our society, but as I reminded people from testimony that the EMP Commission gave back in 2008, they could actually potentially win a nuclear war with us, you know, because the field strengths in the aftermath of their hydrogen bomb test in September that they described as being one of the missions it had was being capable of super powerful EMP attack. They also released a technical report called the EMP Might of Nuclear Weapons that describes accurately a super EMP weapon that could generate 100,000 volts per meter, you know, on the ground. And that exceeds the hardness of our hardest strategic forces, our hardest military systems, which are only hardened to withstand half that.
But Peter Pry, one of the things that I believe you've pointed out, as have others on the EMP Commission, is that the Russians had indicated years ago, I think back in the beginning of the commission's very important work, that they had actually given the North Koreans a super EMP weapons design. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. We were actually demarched in 2004, which is very unusual for the Russians to ever admit to proliferate. They proliferate technology, nuclear, chemical, biological, illegally all the time. But in this case, you know, they claimed that the design leaked accidentally to the North Koreans and that it wasn't their fault, but that Russian nuclear scientists were also in North Korea due to brain drain because Kim Jong-un had offered them so much money. And they predicted that back in 2004 that they thought, you know, because it isn't that hard to build and to design and build a super EMP nuclear weapon, that in a couple of years the North Koreans could have the super. And they just wanted us to be aware of that. And then a couple of years later, right on the money, they tested this, their first nuclear test in 2006. You know, it was a very low yield. Most of the world described it as a failure because of its low yield. But the seismic signal, I mean, it looks exactly like what a super is supposed to be. It's not designed to make a big explosion. It's designed to put out gamma rays. It looks like a fizzle.
Yeah. Peter Pride, let me just mention to our audience that these considerations have prompted you to argue that this threat is of such a magnitude and perhaps of such imminence that a military solution is really the only option available to us. Talk about what you think is required at this moment.
Yes, I think a military solution is necessary because the policy we've been following for 25 years to try to, especially going through China, but also looking for help from Russia. You may have noticed that recently Russia, Vladimir Putin, you know, offered to cut a deal for us with North Korea. I mean, I smell another Putin deal like we had in Syria, disarming them of chemical weapons. In order to understand the North Korean nuclear threat, one has to understand that it was built by with Russian and Chinese help to serve their geostrategic purposes. So the diplomatic solution that we're pursuing actually, you know, to try to go through China, this is exactly what they want, you know, because it proves to our allies that their security is in the hands of Beijing, not in the hands of Washington. And it puts us in the role of a supplicant.
What would you recommend to the President of the United States in light of all of these threats?
I would recommend that we launch a limited conventional strike, a surgical strike, that would take out the ICBMs, the IRBMs, the Yongbyong nuclear reactor, the Sinpo-1, which is their ballistic missile submarine. You know, we could do this in a matter of a few hours. You know, Washington is terrified that Kim would use weapons of mass destruction or kill millions of people in Seoul. While he's a psychopath, I don't think he's suicidal. He's rational enough to understand that if we allowed him to continue to live and control his regime, you know, he wouldn't cross that line. Now, if he did, I'm not saying it's risk-free, you know, but if he did, we should be prepared to eliminate him.
Peter, I assume this would also include taking out those satellites, too. That would presume.
Yes, I would start with that. As a matter of fact, I wrote an article called Disarming Nuclear North Korea back in September, and it could be that we could get a diplomatic solution just by taking out the satellites. I'd recommend starting with that. Taking out the satellites, it would be the first time that the United States has actually demonstrated political will to use a military solution, then perhaps have a pause for diplomacy because we'd be sending that signal to Russia, China, and North Korea that now we're finally serious. We're actually going to defend ourselves.
Peter Pride, let me ask you, because we're almost out of time, speaking of diplomacy, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, made an announcement, I believe, yesterday now to what can only be described as the effect that we're desperate for talks with the North Koreans. We'll take them on any terms. We'll talk about anything they want to talk about. We'll agree to whatever they want in terms of the size of the table and all the rest of it. Give us a sense, Peter, from your cumulative experience of how that's likely to be being read in North Korea. Is it likely to advance our interests or harm them?
It's teaching North Korea that nuclear blackmail works. It is rewarding North Korea for everything it's done and gives them an incentive to continue going down this current path, since the United States is begging for negotiations, is willing to do anything, and it's going to encourage the Chinese and the Russians to support them. You know, because at some point, I mean, there might be a peaceful solution to this. There might be, but it will be on terms that are set by Russia and China that would be saying, look, we'll solve the North Korean problem for you, but we want U.S. to withdraw its military forces from South Korea, from Japan. We want you to behave yourselves in the Middle East, and the price tag will be associated. There can be a peaceful solution if you're basically willing to surrender without war.
Understood. Thank you, my friend, for sharing all this with us. Keep up your great work at the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, and your many contributions to the public policy debate on all these things. We'll have you back soon to talk about, among other things, the falsehoods that are being promoted by some in what we at the Center call the EMP Hall of Shame. But that's for another day. Peter, thank you for joining us. Dinah West is up next. We'll talk with her about the latest travesties out of the Special Counsel's Office and the end of Europe. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's so good to say welcome, particularly to our friend and regular featured guest about this time, Dinah West, a syndicated columnist for many, many years, these days a superb blogger at dinahwest.net. You can also find her writings at the Daily Caller from time to time and elsewhere. She is also the author of two superb and best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Dinah, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Well, I wanted to cover a couple of things with you. I was struck by a piece that Victor Davis Hanson had in National Review yesterday, I believe, in which he went through a bill of particulars, a very nice sort of one-stop shopping on all of the curious coincidences involving the Robert Mueller investigation of the Trump so-called collusion allegations. And how it really seems, I think it's no exaggeration to say, this looks an awful lot like the Hillary Rodham Clinton 2016 campaign doing business as a special counsel's office. What is up with that?
To quote Tom Fitton of Judicial Watch, shut it down. This investigation, so-called, has been compromised from the start, just simply by virtue of the very close career-long relationship between Special Counsel Mueller and former FBI Director James Comey. The more we find out about the interlocking relationships and the behavior and attitudes of the prosecutors involved, the more this becomes, yes, a Hillary Clinton 2.0, an Obama administration 2.0. I mean, this becomes a political exercise, not an investigation on behalf of the American people. And I think that is the basic foundational flaw of what we're watching. And it becomes incumbent upon President Trump to fire Robert Mueller for all of these reasons. He needs to make a case, put it all together, and explain why this is not in the interest of the American people, but in the interest of raw, naked Democratic politics.
You know, the Wall Street Journal yesterday commented that these guys are digging their own graves. Let them keep digging. It's an interesting public policy question, which way to go. Dinah, I wanted to switch gears and talk with you about a topic that I know is very much on your mind and on mine, and that is what seems to be the unraveling of Western civilization in Europe. In the face of, well, what the perps, I guess you might call them, call the Hijra, the migration, the mass migration of Muslims, not all of whom, but many of whom seem to be bringing with them the traditions of Sharia supremacism and conquest of Europe that is changing it before our eyes. A man you admire, as do I, Geert Wilders, a parliamentarian in the Netherlands, a leading force there now, standing up against all of this, is warning that demographic catastrophe is at hand and it's time for Europe to get tough. Talk a little bit about what's happening there as you see it and whether that is still an option for Europe to get tough about all of this.
Yes, well, I think the important thing to assess here is that the Muslims coming into Europe and others are not the change agents that we have to worry about. The change agents are the European Union officials, commissioners, unelected European Union commissioners, that is, and also elected governments across the Eurocrat and the elected governments across Europe. So this does reflect a popular sentiment to a great extent of the indigenous populations who have decided to replace themselves. They have decided to take the ideological extremism of utopian multicultural mixing of the world and live it. And this is much to the distress of probably, say, 20 to 30, 40% of various localities across Europe who would like their cultures and religion survive. So it is a concept. Unfortunately, it is proven to be, in most of these countries, almost all of them, a minority concept or a concept that is suppressed by the mainstream, by the prevailing powers of politics and communications, so that it has become absolutely demonized and people do not act or vote on it. So people have been essentially convinced to extinguish themselves or they partake in it.
That sounds so over the top, Dinah West, that they're going to extinguish themselves. And yet we talked yesterday with Daniel Greenfield about some examples of what is happening, and there are so many. He mentioned in particular, you know, the emergence of what are, let's call them what they are, no-go zones. Rahim Kassam has been documenting them, among others. Rampant anti-Semitism and increasingly constriction of free speech. Our friend Elizabeth Sabatish-Wolf, as we talked about last week, was in town warning of what's happening in Austria, Germany, France, and elsewhere. So when you say extinguishing themselves, allowing Western civ to go down the tubes, what should those of us in this country across the pond be making of all of this that supports what seems to be a pretty hyperbolic statement?
I don't think it's hyperbolic in any sense, because Western civilization does not coexist with Islam inside any national boundary. It never has. As we look across the history of Islamic expansionism throughout the centuries across the continents, it does not coexist with other cultures. It does extinguish them, it does incorporate them, or it does suppress them. So it's actually, I think, a fairly non-hyperbolic statement in terms of what we can learn from historical and contemporary example. So what we should take from that, because our great expanse as a nation, our physical expanse, our demographic situation as it stands right now, we are not necessarily on the same path, but we certainly must take the precaution of halting Islamic immigration. There's just no other way around it when you understand that these, even in Europe, we are looking at very small minorities, no more than, say, 10% of a nation, 15% at the height, maybe tipping toward 18 in France, something like that, 18%. But when we see the switch in the culture, for example, taking England, which has been switched for some years now with a Muslim population that overall does not seem to go above 5%, we understand that there is a very aggressive effort on the part of Muslim communities, mostly in cities and other municipalities, to advance the precepts and cultural norms of Sharia. And this is where you do not find coexistence possible. So the more you import Sharia through Islamic immigration, the more you are extinguishing your own rights, your own society, and indeed the plurality of societies and cultures that do coexist alongside each other. It's not like any of these countries are not monocultural, truly. I mean, they are the product of multiculturalism down through the centuries, whether it's Saxons and Normans, etc. I mean, we're looking at a melting pot.
Dinah, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid, but I did want to just mention that it seems as though the Trump administration is about to unveil a new national security strategy. The National Security Advisor to the President, H.R. McMaster, gave some glimpses of what it might say. Specifically, it seems as though he has come around to the president's view that there is actually such a thing as a radical Islamic ideology. I think Sharia is what its adherents call it. But I think it's too little, too late, and particularly his comment to the effect that there are some Muslim Brotherhood folks that we can do business with, or words to that effect, it suggests that he has got to go. But so do we. Diana, thank you so much. It's great to talk with you. We'll look forward to doing so again next week. In the meantime, keep up the terrific work you do at The Daily Caller, and of course at dianawest.net. Check it out, folks.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I can't be more grateful for our guest, Rosemary Jenks, for stepping into the breach. Rosemary is another of our duty experts on matters involving immigration and national security. She is the Director of Government Relations for the simply indispensable organization Numbers USA, and an incredible resource for all of us concerned about what's happening in this space, particularly on Capitol Hill at the moment, when Republicans, it seems, at least their leaders, are now aligning with the Democrats to adopt a new amnesty for illegal aliens. Rosemary, say it ain't so.
Well, unfortunately, Frank, it is. It is absolutely so. There are backroom deals being made as we speak. Of course, none of this will go public until the very last minute when they believe it's too late to get out of it. But they absolutely are planning for an amnesty. And by the way, not just for the 690,000 DACA recipients. What the Senate is talking about is well over that. I mean, the plan that they're beginning with from Senators Grassley and Cornyn is 1.9 million potential amnesty illegal aliens. And then on top of that, you know, there's going to be fraud. There's going to be another surge at the border. I mean, this is bad news for the country. It's bad news for American workers who are going to have to compete for jobs. And it's bad news for American taxpayers.
Now, Rosemary, when you say there's 1.9 million, is that the chain migration expanded numbers, or is that not taking them into account?
No, that's just the amnesty, because they are not, they're going beyond just the DACA population and saying that anyone who is here but didn't apply for DACA but might be eligible can still apply. So the estimate is that 1.9 million illegal aliens could qualify.
And then there's the chain migration on top of that. I understood it was something like 3 million if the initial baseline was 700,000 or 800,000. If it's 1.9 million, does that get you up to 7 or 8 million with chain migration of family members and extended family and the like?
Well, the average immigrant to the United States sponsors 3-point-something additional family members. So it's multiplied by at least 3. But what the bill that they're starting with in the Senate does actually eliminate chain migration. So if they keep that in there, it would be limited to the 1.9 million illegal aliens. Now, whether or not Democrats will go along with keeping it in there is yet to be seen. But that's at least their starting point for the negotiation.
Let me just ask you, the question of what is in this package, of course, is one of the open uncertainties. There's also talk that they're going to do something about enhancing border security. Chuck Schumer was making much of that the other day. I gather you're taking that with a grain of salt, shall we say?
Yes. Well, I mean, this is the thing. What Senator Durbin has proposed is basically, you know, we'll add some money for some cameras along the border and some technology. So, just like in 1986, what the Democrats want to do is trade a promise of enforcement for a very large amnesty. That is just not acceptable. And, you know, we are going to need the American people to tell their members of Congress that they are not going to fall for this again. We did it in 1986. The result was 3 million illegal aliens amnestied, and then a surge of 11 million new illegal aliens. We never got the enforcement. It will not work.
It's Lucy and the football, I think, is how this works.
They keep getting it pulled out from under them. But there's a certain degree of connivance on the part of the Republicans, to be sure, on this. And I was so interested. You've had quite the time with a congressman by the name of Scott Taylor of Virginia, who did not like Numbers USA doing what you do better than anybody else, which is to put the Klieg lights on people selling out our country in this kind of fashion. Tell us what Congressman Taylor has done in the aftermath of your exposing what was a letter in the public domain, for heaven's sakes. I mean, it wasn't even what they were doing behind closed doors, was it?
No, yeah, he actually led a letter to the Republican leadership of the House. It was signed by 34 Republicans, but he was the lead carrier of the letter that called for an amnesty for the DACA population before the end of the year. And so, you know, we put up Facebook posts on all of the 34 signers, including Scott Taylor, and said, you know, these people want permanent amnesty for Obama's DACA amnesty. And he did not like that at all and made that very clear to us.
Well, let me just say that I won't ask you to comment on it if you don't care to, but there were published reports that he threatened to blow up your office, which is a rather extraordinary thing for a member of Congress, or for that matter, anybody to do. But it really speaks to the passions that are apparently at work here, at the very least. And Rosemary, again, I think what you do in trying to help the rest of us understand the stakes here, if another, well, close to 2 million minimum illegal aliens are given an amnesty and the border is not actually secured before that happens, it is, as you say, absolutely predictable. We'll have more illegals coming in looking for amnesty as well, just as happened during Reagan's time. We also have this story this week, of course, of a teachable moment, as President Obama might put it, though I'm sure he wouldn't about this. The incident in New York City involving this fellow, Kayad Ullah, who was a product of a chain migration from Bangladesh. This has prompted, apparently, Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, and Kirstjen Nielsen, the new Homeland Security Secretary, to embrace very heartily, I gather, the idea of merit-based immigration, something the president's also been talking about for some time. Is that in prospect now, Rosemary, given what you're describing going on the Hill?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think Congress wants to do the absolute minimum on immigration that it can get away with. They don't want to control the flow of labor, essentially, and voters for Democrats into the United States. So they want to tinker around the edges. They, of course, want to give this amnesty to follow through with what President Obama did. But I think they are talking about including an end to chain migration in this DACA thing, but they are not so far talking about moving to a merit-based system. And, you know, it's interesting because this Bangladeshi terrorist actually came here as the nephew of a U.S. citizen who came here as a lottery winner. He won the visa lottery. So these are two programs, the extended chain migration and the visa lottery, that absolutely need to go, should never have been put in the law in the first place, and haven't been. I mean, the lottery was created in 1990. The extended family chain migration was put into the law in 1965. So, you know, these are not traditional immigration flows for the United States, and they should never have been put in the law, and they should be ended.
Yeah, they should be ended indeed. But again, my question is, in the present environment, as you say, Congress would just as soon not only do nothing to curb this kind of flow, they'd like to perpetuate it and perhaps even arguably intensify it. And Rosemary Jenks at Numbers USA, I know you are standing athwart this as best you can. What can people do who are of a mind with you and me that this kind of immigration practice, whether it's the insane lotteries or whether it's the chain migration or whether it's the amnesties, need to stop?
People need to contact their members of Congress, and they need to say, first of all, no amnesty. Like, let's get past this idea that we owe illegal aliens the right to stay here. Second, let's have an immigration system that serves our interests, not the interests of people around the world who want to come here. This should be, it's a public policy. This should be about what's best for America.
And they can find out more information about how to do all of that at numbersusa.com. I commend it to you, numbersusa.com. Rosemary Jenks, thank you for your splendid work there. I know you'll come back to us soon with updates. And in the meantime, I hope you'll stay very well and be successful. God bless you. Next up, Itamar Marcus joins us. We'll get his take on the fraudulent peace process in the Middle East and what we can do about it right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and it couldn't be with greater pleasure that I say we are joined by Itamar Marcus, a man I have admired greatly over the years for his clarity of thought, his candor, his honesty about a subject that too few in the business bring to the subject of the so-called peace process in the Middle East. There's much talk about it in the aftermath of President Trump's announcement that he's going to recognize reality and acknowledge that Israel's capital is Jerusalem and that our embassy will be there. This has prompted our guest Itamar Marcus to describe him as the new Balfour, a topic that I wanted to explore with him, as well as what the Palestinians have been doing and are doing now and will likely continue to do if we tolerate more of their misbehavior. Itamar Marcus is the founder and director of an indispensable organization in Israel, the Palestinian Media Watch. In years past, he has been involved by his government in negotiations with the Palestinian Authority, specifically on the subject he monitors so closely at PMW, and that is incitement by the Palestinians, an activity that continues very much at the moment. Itamar Marcus, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us. I appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Thanks so much. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Remind us of who the original Balfour was, what role he played, and why Donald Trump is, in your estimation, 2.0.
Well, the original Balfour was the British Foreign Secretary in 1917 who issued the Balfour Declaration, a letter to the Zionist movement essentially saying that Britain would support the goal of creating a Jewish state in the Jewish people's ancient homeland in Israel. The Palestinian Authority denies Israel's right to exist, and therefore they see Balfour as literally one of the great criminals of history, and they've said so many times. And now what they're saying is that because the Jews have no history in Jerusalem, President Trump's announcing that he will move the embassy there and recognize it as the capital of Israel, they say, is a second Balfour. He's recognizing something that's not based in history. The Jews have no history in the land, no history in Jerusalem. He can't give them Jerusalem. They go even further. They've created a fictitious Palestinian history. And the person who said it is none other than Mahmoud al-Abbas, who's Abbas's personal advisor on Islam, the most important religious figure in the PA, just said a few days ago, "We Palestinians have a 5,000-year-old history in Jerusalem, and you have none." This is the falsification of history that they do. Based on this, they want the United States and the world to follow and create a fictitious policy.
Indeed, and ultimately have the removal of Israel, let's be clear, as their stated policy. That brings us to the behavior of the Palestinians in the aftermath of this announcement by the president, particularly. Itamar, you follow very closely what they put out in their official media, what they are disseminating to their population through other means, notably what they are inculcating in their children, in their schools and propaganda outlets. I think it's fair to characterize it as incitement. Has there been any diminution of that of late? And if not, why on earth is it that we continue to subsidize the operations of the Palestinian Authority in the United States?
Yes, it's something that's almost impossible to fathom sometimes. The Palestinian Authority has been condemning in the most outrageous language. They've called
Trump the America's crazy man. They've been burning him in effigy. They've been burning American flags. This is being done to the country that's given them the most amount of foreign aid since the Palestinian Authority was founded, and the United States continues to do so. They have threatened United States interests around the world, and they're literally asking their people, they're asking Muslims around the world, to target American targets. Mahmoud al-Abbas, that same advisor to Abbas, said that he's calling on the Muslims around the world to act against this terrible action of Trump that he had no right to do.
So, Itamar, it seems as though it's not really working. There have been demonstrations, to be sure. There have been some violence, some loss of life, regrettably. But it seems as though, by and large, this is not amounting to anything remotely like a new intifada. Is that the case?
I think you're correct. The Palestinian population is fed up with their leadership. They're fed up with them because they're corrupt. All the polls in the last year find that 80% of Palestinians believe that the government is corrupt, and 65% want Mahmoud Abbas to actually resign.
His mandate expired, a decade or so ago, so it's not too unreasonable for them to want him gone. But does that mean that they really would prefer Hamas?
I think they find Hamas is also corrupt. Most polls that have been taken consistently find Palestinians, even if, I would say 65% of Palestinians say that even if a peace treaty and a two-state solution were found that would satisfy all of their demands, they would still want to continue fighting to destroy Israel. So the alternative that they're seeking, I think, is the same ideology, but with non-corrupt leaders. You know, one time it'll be Hamas, one time it'll be Fatah. The population is a very religious population. Polls find that 95% of Palestinians say religion is important to them. So Hamas, which is promoting a more religious ideology, naturally has a tremendous amount of support in the Palestinian Authority from the population. Basically, what's happening is people are voting against the one they think that is less corrupt right now.
So what we're dealing with, as we discussed earlier in the program with Dinah West, really is Sharia supremacism from one outlet or another of this Palestinian so-called leadership. And this brings me to my last question to you, Itamar Marcus of Palestinian Media Watch, and that is, Vice President Pence is headed to Israel, to the Holy Land. The Palestinians have apparently said they will not meet with him in protest of what the president has done, that the U.S. involvement in peacemaking is at an end. It seems to me that that's absurd on the face of it, but two things. One, it certainly should mean that we have nothing more to do with them either, including subsidizing their corrupt operations, but also that we begin, as our friend Daniel Pipes has talked about, pursuing a policy that is really fundamentally different, that recognizes, again, reality, that Israel actually defeated the Arabs, including the Palestinians, and that what should be done now is basically dictating terms. What are your thoughts on all of that, please?
I agree completely with you and with Daniel Pipes on this issue. And I think here was an incredible opportunity. It shouldn't have been the Palestinians who said they wouldn't meet with Pence. It should have been the United States announcing that there will be no meetings by any American leader with any Palestinian Authority leader, and that every Palestinian Authority official will not be given a visa for travel to the United States until the Palestinian Authority leadership not only stops inciting violence, but actually retracts it, apologizes, and condemns all the officials who called for violence. The fact that the Palestinian Authority is taking the upper hand here and dictating to the United States that they won't meet is such a reversal of the natural roles here. The Palestinian Authority is so dependent on the United States, and the United States has been for years letting itself get kicked around, pushed, insulted, and threatened by the Palestinian Authority. And that is no way to achieve peace. If you want to achieve peace, you have to put them in their place and achieve a political diplomatic victory, make them come begging to the United States, please accept us in your country, please talk to us, and only then could a peace process begin.
Itamar, this is such an important insight, and it seems so commonsensical, and yet the foreign policy elite in this country and elsewhere around the world has got this completely upside down. The trouble is, as you know so well from your work at Palestinian Media Watch, among other studies of this mentality, is when you behave as we have been. They read it as submission, and their behavior can only get worse. It's the height of folly to persist in it. We can't continue to do that. I hope the vice president has a safe trip and has splendid conversations with those who deserve to speak with him, including those, of course, in the Israeli government. Thank you for your time discussing all this with us. I hope you come back to us again in the very near future. In the meantime, keep up your good work at Palestinian Media Watch. Check it out there, folks. palwatch.org. I hope the rest of you will also come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.